Mark Revisited, number 23. The second feeding miracle, Jesus feeding 4,000, and our reading will be chapter 8, 1 through to chapter 8, 21. Then I'll take this long passage in two chunks, first 8, 1 to 13, with some glances ahead to the fascinating dialogue in the boat, or when they reach shore, whichever it is. So chapter 8, verse 1. During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way, because some of them have come a long distance." His disciples answer, "But where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them?" "How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked. "Seven," they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over, and about 4,000 men were present. And having sent them away, Jesus got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. Jesus sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for 1 loaf they had with them in the boat. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." They discussed this with one another and said, "It's because we've no bread." Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you still have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" 12, they replied. "And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" They answered, 7. He said to them, "Do you still not understand?" It has been regularly assumed, though not by more conservative scholars, that this second feeding miracle is identical with that in chapter 6, and that the two stories are variants of the same account. This theory goes back to the 19th century in Germany, and it is now standard fare in the academy, nor is it hard to see why. To take one example only, in Anderson's words, the disciples' question in verse 4 would be inconceivable on top of the previous miraculous feeding. So it is said this miracle is a doublet of 6:34 to 44. But just how assured is this result of modern critical study? Normally, I've not spent time on matters of this kind, partly because most of my listeners are already familiar with them, but also because our concern is with the text as we have received it. However, this time I decided, largely for my own benefit, to look into the matter. Hopefully, this may be of some interest to any who remain confused by the conflicting claims. For others, well, they're free to skip the session and wait until we join the company in the boat. In reality, arguments against the theory of one feeding and two accounts are formidable. A simple sentence in Alford's Greek Testament serves as an introductory assessment, namely that, I quote, "Every circumstance that could vary in the accounts does vary." I imagine Sherlock Holmes taking on the case and telling the astonished Watson that he had noticed 22 differences between the two records. That would be a slight exaggeration, but a careful reader can settle down and list plenty of these for themselves. If the second feeding is but a repetition of the first, Mark has been incredibly careless about details. One variation is famously noted by many commentators and I guess is familiar to every Bible student. Here is L. Plummer, never an inspired writer, but a detail man, punctilious and precise over every dot and comma. I quote, "The marked difference of the words for baskets in the narrative of the two miracles, and also the allusions to them afterwards, verses 19 and 20, is one of the strongest arguments against the identification of the two." I will read 19 and 20 once more. It's when Jesus says, "Don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves, how many baskets did you pick up? And then when I broke the 7 loaves, how many baskets or pieces did you pick up?" And the words for baskets are totally different, as in the original story. One commenter goes as far as saying that if there was but one feeding only, then these supposed words of Jesus would appear to be a forgery. But enough of comparatively minor matters. For me, there's only one issue that is of clinching importance. What is certain is that Mark believed in two miraculous feedings. Could this writer, whose work so far has impressed us for its integrity, have made so crass a mistake? Remember, his ultimate mentor was Peter, an eyewitness. And consider the contemporaries of Mark in the 60s, who would remember Jesus and his supreme miracles. And again, would Matthew, in his record, have continued such a gross blunder? Matthew 15:29-39. Needless to say, one can wriggle out of all this by blaming sources, but I doubt if it impresses the candid reader. So then, what are we to make of verse 4 and the disciples' question? Let me read it again. Where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? Had they really forgotten what had happened before? This has been the view of several scholars and many Christians. For a long time I held this view myself. And it may not immediately convince, but the case has seldom been put together better than by Archbishop Trench in his 19th century Notes on the Miracles, still to be found in any decent theological library. As well as erudition, the great man had rare spiritual insight that is worth hearing on any account, so I want to quote part of it for you. I find Trench's comments true to Christian experience, painfully so in my own life. Quote from Trench, Notes on the Miracles. "At first it excites some surprise that the disciples with that other miracle fresh in their memories should now have been as much at a loss how the multitude should be fed as they were before. Yet this surprise arises out of our ignorance of man's heart, of our own heart, and of the deep root of unbelief which is there. It is ever more thus in times of difficulty and distress. All former deliverances are in danger of being forgotten. The mighty interpositions of God's hand in former passages of men's lives fall out of their memories. Each new difficulty appears insurmountable, as one from which there is no extrication. At each recurring necessity, it seems as though the wonders of God's grace are exhausted and have come to an end. God may have divided the Red Sea for Israel, yet no sooner are they on the other side than because there's no water to drink, they murmur against Moses and count that they must perish for thirst, crying, 'Is the Lord among us or not?' Or to adduce a still nearer parable, once already the Lord had covered the camp with quails, yet for all this, even Moses himself cannot believe that he will provide flesh for all that multitude. It's only the man of full-formed faith, a faith such as the apostles themselves at this time did not possess, who argues from the past to the future and truly derives confidence from God's former dealings of faithfulness and love." And then he adds, "Nothing but a strange unacquaintance with the heart of man could have made any find here an evidence of the inaccuracy and general untrustworthiness of the records of our Lord's life." Well, as I say, I find Trench's comments painfully true to my own experience, but I have to say it as an explanation for the disciples' frank response to their master. Well, that's another matter. It seems so unlikely to me that all 12 men would forget the staggering miracle not long before, when Jesus had fed over 5,000 people with a few loaves and fish. Question, is there another answer that meets the case? And I think there is. But first we must return to Baker Street and hear Holmes tell that dumb old Watson why a particular detective inspector, was it Lestrade, though very gifted, would not reach the top of his profession. And the reason? Lack of imagination. By which I think he meant creative thinking that tries to penetrate a situation and see what might actually have occurred. Here then, for what it is worth, is my assessment of what was going on. I will try to be brief. One, on the surface, the two scenes are very different. In the first feeding, by the lakeside, the crowds confronting Jesus are with him for one day only, before being dismissed, while Jesus seeks solitude for prayer. Though it is a remote area, what is intriguing is, according to the testimony of the disciples, it's perfectly possible for this crowd to go and find food in the surrounding farms and villages. In other words, a miracle was not absolutely necessary, though Jesus chose to perform one. What the disciples protested about then was what it would cost to provide food for all, a ridiculous amount quite beyond them. It's a cheeky response if you like, but it does not deny that it would have been possible for them to get provisions, only that the money needed was vast. So not where was the food to come from, but where was such a large sum of money to come from in order to buy it? In the second feeding, the people are with Jesus for 3 whole days and have nothing now to eat, since anything they brought with them must be largely gone. But is this not extraordinary? I don't recall any commentator asking how it could ever come about that so many people would stay out in a remote desert area for so long and without food to sustain them. It seems bizarre. These are working men with jobs to do and families to support. I think the only evidence we have for this is the evidence of the text. And in this case, the parallel passage in Matthew is illuminating. Matthew 15:29 following in the NIV, Jesus feeds the 4,000. Jesus left then, went along the Sea of Galilee, then he went up onto a mountainside and sat down. Great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and laid them at his feet, and he healed them. The people were amazed at what they saw, the mute speaking, the crippled made well, the lame walking, the blind seeing, and they praised the God of Israel. Now this is as graphic a summary of the healing miracles in brief as anywhere in the gospel record. The hitherto lame are leaping about in excitement, the blind are marvelling at what they can now see, the crippled are standing upright, the mute are talking, laughing, shouting for joy. We can easily think of fear, of tears, hugs, even screams of joy. Can you believe what you're reading? Could they believe what they were seeing and experiencing? Here are words to hear and works to see that the world had hitherto never known and that previous generations would have loved and longed to witness. So the crowd cannot leave him. He has done all things well. It's like a new world altogether. Now please note what both the Lord and the 12 are agreed upon. This time, they are far from the villages and farms and all human help. Jesus says explicitly, if I send them away hungry, they will collapse on the way, because some of them have come a long distance, literally, from afar. And in their blunt way, the disciples agree, for their response is as follows, where in the world can we or anyone else find food to eat here, far from human provision? How wooden and unimaginative we can be. This verse 4 comment is not one disciple speaking, but the view of the 12 together. Surely they've been talking among themselves. Like everyone else, they realize that in their master they have someone who seems to have come from another world, with superhuman power, like an ancient prophet risen from the dead. So when this time, and the text is quite distinct, Jesus calls his disciples to come and gather round him, while he tells them of his concern for the people without sustenance to get home safely, what are they thinking? They dare not tell their master what to do. All previous experience would prevent that foolishness. So one of them, or several, blurt out, "Well, Lord, there's no human help in this place, that's for sure." The implication is quite plain. If anything's going to happen, you must do it. To which Jesus immediately responds, "How many loaves do you have?" "That will be enough. 7 little flat cakes of barley or wheat. If in his hands, that will be sufficient. I need say no more. And the leftovers? Enough to feed several hundred more people." Incidentally, the old rationalization that everyone shared their lunchtime sandwich equivalents nowhere near meets the case when 3 days have been spent with Jesus. But these old chestnuts never die. There may always be Christian students, Christian Bible students, who are not persuaded by Mark's account, and I have not the least intention of following the politicians who think that those who disagree with them are fruitcakes and loons. But I would suggest that the real issue is Mark himself. With all his sources of information to help and guide him, it must be at the very least a risky business at our distance to doubt his certainties. Finally, however much the 12 were in awe of their master and leader, they're still from far understanding him, and to that we must now turn next time.